played steel-toothed villain Jaws in two 007 films. He's died at a hospital in California. So Rogers says he was a delight to work with.
He played bad, but was a really good man. I think the only way of summing up for him was he was a big man with an even bigger heart.
And George Clooney is to appear in a special episode of Downton Abbey. He's filmed a one-off sketch of the period drama for a charity appeal. That's the latest. I'm Lindsay Brown.
This is your award-winning BCFM.
BCFM
on 93.2,
24 hours a day.
What matters to Bristol?
If you look around Bristol right now, everything's spread apart.
The major thing is lack of language.
We ask the questions.
I'm pretty sure if you ask me what I think the Colson Hall will be called in 5 years' time, that it will be a different name.
First with the names that count.
Together we can make Bristol a true creative city and art and culture city.
Blue and red, seriously, representing colours, that's just ridiculous.
Your story.
My name is Princess Campbell, MBE. Anything wrong, I try to put it right.
What matters to Bristol?
Every human, every individual have rights to express their freedom the way they want to be. Bristol Pride! Bristol Pride!
I think community radio is a very, very valuable instrument, and I wish your station every success.
There is more to life than money, weed and girls.
Wherever you are, BCFM 93.2 are the station you can count on to represent Bristol.
Greetings to the people of Bristol in Nima Selassie Ija.
I'm privileged to be Bristolian.
I'm Steve Taylor. I'm the principal at Bristol Metropolitan Academy. I love Bristol because it's a vibrant, exciting place. I've lived here a long time. I've never, ever been bored.
You can listen again to any shows at bcfmradio.com and leave comments about your favourite programmes. BCFM 93.2, your interactive station, 24 hours.
Hello and welcome to Dialect. Dialect is Bristol's first weekly podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002 and goes out every Thursday morning at 11 a.m. here on BCFM 93.2 FM.
We'll be right back.
That was Changeling by DJ Shadow. Get your pinch of salt ready now for the North Korean propaganda section.
This is a film about psychological warfare. A specific type of warfare designed to distract, misinform,
but trust me,
and anesthetize the brain. Of course, such Machiavellian activity requires a disguise, which is why propagandists call themselves the public relations industry. Public relations and propaganda are interchangeable, and it is the massive public relations industry that is designed to alter perception, reshape reality, and manufacture consent.
A $200,000 backdrop for official war briefings.
Today, America alone has more public relations propagandists than reporters, which means that nearly half of what people in the West hear, see, or read is written by professional liars. Professional liars whose job it is to keep people in front of their televisions, reading gossip magazines, eating vast amounts of toxic food, and shopping, always shopping, for the latest fashions and trends. Anything that keeps the masses from organizing themselves and asking important questions about what their masters are really up to. Fashion, celebrity, sex, music, technology, any kind of revolution except the social revolution. In this film, we will reveal the methods used by the propagandists to control populations on behalf of their owners. Although these rich and powerful owners only make up 1% of the world's population, they have mastered the use of propaganda over 99% of the world's population, turning them into consumer slaves who work harder and harder to buy things they don't need. These consumer slaves are also made to pay taxes to their government, money which is used to develop new weapons for the pernicious invasions and occupations of other countries. In the last 5 years alone, they've given their owners more than $1 trillion for these illegal and immoral wars that can't be won, and are even encouraged to send their own children to fight them.
What kind of stories?
This is Doctor of Psychology, Professor Kim. You have just been exposed to a range of propaganda devices used by the West to control, manipulate, neutralize, and anesthetize entire populations. The success of these mind-warping devices depends on their remaining hidden from the masses. That's the whole point of good propaganda. You want to create a slogan that nobody's going to be against and everybody's going to be for. Nobody knows what it means because it doesn't mean anything. Points out Professor Noam Chomsky. With this in mind, propagandists can provide simple answers to complex problems and ask for approval without question.
Either you're with us, either you love freedom, or you're with the enemy.
They can use this method to sell phones, violence, cosmetics, or even false wars, like the unwinnable war on terror announced by these degenerates. The most popular slogans contain virtue words that embody what slaves in the West have been conditioned to value most dearly. Words like freedom, truth, peace, liberty, and most importantly, democracy. Since 1945, America has tried to overthrow 50 governments, many of them democracies. In the process, over 30 countries and their people have been attacked.
I want peace as much as you do.
The grotesque act of invading other countries, claiming them as your territory, and stealing their resources to keep your emperor, crown, or corporate owners in power, used to be known as empire building. The latest propaganda slogan for empire building is globalization, a vague word with warm connotations of unification. But what it really means is the acquisition of other people's resources at any cost and unlimited slave labor. Slave labor needed to produce the unnecessary goods sold to these slaves. Slaves to persuasion and influence. In reality, these are debt slaves, since they can't even afford the things they buy. Even in times of peril and economic meltdown, at the orders of their president, they must keep consuming. Is this democracy? On February 15, 2003, millions of people worldwide took to the streets in the world's largest ever day of protest, a protest against the pirate Bush regime and their British and Australian lapdogs who wanted to go to war on manufactured grounds. The majority of the world voted against this war, but were ignored. Is this democracy? The powerful 1% went ahead with their pre-planned war. As always, using the poorest people's children to do the fighting.
Be here or you fucking freedom! So back up right now!
A real war on terror would start with American citizens refusing to pay taxes that support Israel's illegal occupation of Palestine. Taxes that could be used to help Americans who are unemployed, working without health care, and homeless. Of course, if you dared to point this out in America, you would be named anti-American and a traitor, or one of those who hate freedom. So people keep quiet because they are afraid of expressing how they feel. You've got to keep them pretty scared, because unless they're properly scared and frightened that all sorts of devils are going to destroy them from outside or inside or somewhere, they may start to think, which is very dangerous, because they're not competent to think. Therefore, it's important to distract them and marginalize them.
I have said to the people of Iraq that our quarrel was not with them, but instead with their leadership, and above all with Saddam Hussein. You, the people of Iraq, are not our enemy. We do not seek your destruction.
This man clearly enjoys killing people. Even though he was too scared to fight for his country during the American War of Aggression in Vietnam, he broke all records for killing prisoners during his time as governor of Texas. They are strongly against democracy. Because in a true democracy, these treacherous monsters would be impeached and sentenced to death for lying, fraud, treason, race hate, mass murder, and war crimes. Here we see the most obvious lie in democracy, the one that two candidates represent a choice when they are clearly run by the same interests. There is actually a single-party system in the United States, This charming president will do exactly what he is told to do by his corporate masters, spending countless billions on killing humans in faraway lands while his own people continue to suffer. Democracy is just a slogan.
Roger. Good job. I saw you splatter one right in the back with a rocket.
Roger, got lucky again.
When carrying out attacks on other nations, destroying their infrastructure, and deforming their future generations with the use of nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons, the imperialist needs to rewrite history and keep repeating it over and over until it becomes true.
Young lady with the red hair right behind the school teacher there.
Mr. President, why did you drop the atom bomb?
Mr. President, the future wants to know, was it right to drop the atom bomb?
I made the only decision I ever knew how to make. I did what I thought was right.
In my line of work, you got to keep repeating things over and over and over again for the truth to sink in, to kind of catapult the propaganda.
George W. Bush.
But America is not the only perpetrator of crimes against humanity and the planet. Imperialism is in the heart of the British, occupying India and running opium wars out of China. Its witches in the spine of the wicked Japanese, the French in every continent, and the World Bank and IMF in every poor country since World War II. All have committed grave crimes against humanity in their search to conquer, steal, and erase memories with their lies. Lies like Australia Day, a celebration of the day in 1788 when Australians, who were merely geographically displaced European criminals deemed unworthy of being on British soil, were sent off to settle as far away as possible. These low-grade humans call Australia the lucky country. But their arrival was not so lucky for the Aborigines, who had been there for 40,000 years. For them, the oldest human presence on Earth, the lucky country is a propaganda phrase used to cover up Australia's most enduring taboo, genocide. White Australians don't like that word. They admit to words like pacifying, killing, cleansing, excluding, exterminating, poisoning, shooting, and starving. Anything but genocide. Anything but the truth. It is a remarkable fact that modern propaganda began with the British, who established a secret war propaganda bureau in 1914 in order to sway American public opinion and gain sympathy for the Allied cause. It was headed by George Creel, who described it as a vast enterprise in salesmanship, the world's greatest adventure in advertising. His immediate job was to convince the pacifist American people that a war some 4,000 miles away was worth fighting, even though American soil was not threatened. The process worked so well that Americans learned to hate German civilians almost as much as the targeted German government. And just 6 months after his re-election, on a stay out of the war pledge, President Woodrow Wilson declared war on Germany. While the British abandoned propaganda in peacetime, the Americans maintained its use under the leadership of Creel Commission psychologist Edward Bernays, who argued that American public opinion must be engineered from above by society's few masters.
1% 집단.
The 1%.
우합 지졸들을
to control the rabble.
So Eddie began to.
The business world then turned to Bernays to indoctrinate citizens with the capitalist story until the masses willingly adopted the idea that America is a country of big business, by big business, and for big business. Fascism should more appropriately be called corporatism because it is a merger of state and corporate power. Benito Mussolini. Meanwhile, Nazi propaganda minister Joseph Goebbels was openly thanking the British and Americans for their propaganda model and put it to good use for rallying the German people to war. Historical documents prove that Goebbels ordered stormtroopers to burn down the German Reichstag, which he blamed on the communists. This had the desired effect of frightening the population, who surrendered their civil rights and enabled the Nazis to swiftly transform Germany from republic to fascist state and launch World War II.
In 1940, Hitler had conquered France.
35 million lives were given up in World War II in patriotic fervor created by propaganda campaigns. As if using propaganda to send their pacifist population to war wasn't bad enough, consider how America repaid its people for defeating the Nazis.
그리 나쁘지만도 않은 것이었다.
Operation Paperclip. Operation Paperclip was the safe transfer of Nazi scientists and operatives into the CIA. Nazis like Josef Mengele, the infamous Angel of Death, who carried out live experiments on humans in the death camp. These death industry pros were given new identities as U.S. citizens and employed in U.S. laboratories to develop a dazzling array of mind control programs for the CIA, as well as new products and ideas for U.S. biochemical warfare expansion.
Ultimately, they discovered LSD, all that drug stuff.
General Electric, DuPont.
Not only did companies like General Electric, DuPont, Ford, and Bell help with Operation Paperclip, but so did Americans like Prescott Bush, the patriarch of the presidents George Bush. Documents in the National Archives and Library of Congress show that he committed treason continuously between 1924 and 1951. First, by using Jewish slave labor in collusion with the Nazis, and then by bringing those Nazis and their assets into America. Despite being a traitor to his country, this Nazi collaborator became a senator, and his family has assumed great power in America. But they are not the only fascist family to thrive from tyranny against humanity. Court records show that the Rockefeller's Standard Oil Company was selling more oil to Hitler's war effort than to the Allies. And for this, a federal judge ruled John D. Rockefeller committed treason against the United States. Treason, the most heinous crime of all. Prior to World War II, this man joined fellow traitor Prescott Bush and the British royal family in sponsoring the eugenics initiatives that gave rise to Hitler's racial hygiene program.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
And now, once again, we're going to hear a clip from creation scientist Kent Hovind. As mentioned before, Kent has taught creation lectures in schools for decades over in America, explaining evidence on subjects such as Noah's flood to exposing the Darwinian theory, as well as educating people about the New World Order eugenics programs that existed since 1900.
A
professor from Iowa said, you should fail any student if you find out he's a creationist. We don't want anybody to get a degree from our university who believes in creation. That's their philosophy. If the professor discovers the student is a creationist, you should fail him. Furthermore, the student's department should have the right of retracting his grade and possibly his degree if he becomes a creationist later. That's real academic freedom, isn't it? Yep, Soviet style. Here we have whole chapters teaching evolution. We're paying for it. And they are very carefully censoring out any mention of creation. I collect the books, folks. I got hundreds of them. I know what I'm talking about on this one. Come to my house and see them. I can show you a page after. I got several pages here photocopied out of there. Unbelievable stuff from the textbooks. Here the kids in Holt Biology 1994 edition have to be tested on this material. Boys and girls, life arose from non-living matter. Is that a scientific fact? No. Has anybody ever seen that? No. Can we even imagine how it could happen? No. But they have to be tested on it. Learn it and take a test. Don't they? How about this? The Earth is 4.5 billion years old. There's a lot of ways to prove that's not true. But you know what? This is one way they can weed out those who don't believe in evolution. It's got to be on the test. The guy who's translating my materials into Russian lives two blocks away from me. Grew up in the Ukraine. But he got done with high school, excellent grades all through high school. Senior year, he took a test. One of the questions on the test was, do you believe in evolution, yes or no? He checked no. They refused to let him graduate. They finally sent him his diploma 35 years later in the mail. Refused to let him graduate because he believed in creation. That's the only reason. So that couldn't happen here. Well, not yet, but it's getting close. There's a real persecution, folks. I was at at Yale University a couple of weeks ago. As I stood there in the museum, at Peabody Museum in Yale, Connecticut, hundreds of kids came through. Just looked at the dinosaurs as the guides were telling them all about evolution at taxpayer expense. It just was all I could do to keep my calm, tempered, I keep my normal self in line. I talked to one of the women who's leading one of the groups. I walked up to her. She said, hey, nice tie. Dinosaurs. I always have dinosaurs on my tie. I said, yeah, I speak on dinosaurs all over the world. She said, really? I said, yeah. She said, man, that's great. I said, yeah, I do it from a creation perspective. You should have seen her face change. Here we are brainwashing a whole generation, kids by the thousands, in your school district right here. I mean, tomorrow, they're going to be brainwashed at your expense, right? No question. There's a lot of conspiracies out there. But I want to show you from a different side here tonight what we should do. The World Council of Churches is very involved in bringing a new world order. The Masonic Lodge, probably one of the key players. Now, the average guy in the Masons doesn't know what he's in. He thinks he does. But there's a secret club inside that secret club. They use that as their recruiting grounds because they know they have to keep quiet. They've taken all these oaths, you know. Yank my liver out and beat me on the head with it. Right? Tie me down by the lowest tide, you know, onto a stake and cut my guts open and let the birds come eat me off the stake. Dumb oath they take. Any Christian ought to get out of that group. But you can get in the Masonic Lodge and get clear up to 32nd degree and not know what you're in. You'll think it's a do-gooders club. And they do a lot of good for the community. I don't argue with that. But when you get to 33rd degree, you start to find out, wow, this is a satanic organization. Oh, sure is. All this time we've been talking about God, they're talking about Lucifer as God. Albert Pike ought to know. He was the leader of the entire Masonic Lodge. I mean, the world leader. He said, the Masonic religion should be, by all of us initiates of the highest degrees, maintained in the purity of the Luciferian doctrine. He was 33rd degree Mason, just like Bob Dole and Kemp. Ah. Masonic Lodge? Now look, I've got good friends that are in it. And I love you, and God loves you, and you're not my enemy. And I know you think you're in a do-gooders club, but you have been deceived. You're working for the devil and don't even know it. Get out of that. Jesus said, I've done nothing in secret. Why do they do all these secret meetings, secret handshake? You know, grab the second knuckle and stand just right and, you know, do all these secret motions. I'll let them know, hey, I'm a Mason. Why? Jesus didn't do anything in secret. Nope. Did it openly. I think we need to come out from among them, be separate, saith the Lord. Second Corinthians chapter 6.
That was the last in a series of lectures from creation scientist Kent Hovind.
Crystal Community FM 93.2. Your voice, your choice.
Now moving on to something a little more cheerful, a clip from Tony interviewing community activist Chris Coates, taking you through a retrospective of the history, current practice and future potential of co-housing community living initiatives.
My name's Chris Coates. I've become the unofficial historian of communal living in this country. Just recently published a book called Communes Britannica on the, I call it the post-war history, but it covers the sort of pacifist, starts with the pacifist communities during the Second World War and comes right up to, well, I stopped at the year 2000, and it covers whole everything in between.
So what is it about communes and communal living? Why do people want to sort of create communities like this?
There's a whole set of reasons people want to set up communities. I mean, there's the whole spiritual side of it. There's Buddhist communities, Christian communities, communities that some people would call cults. There's a sort of New Age spiritual communities like Findhorn. And then there's a whole range of other things, back to the land, people who want to move back to the land, and it's much more feasible if you do it collectively. You're not isolated in a rural community. Your buying power in terms of getting hold of land is better. And then there's whole urban activists who sort of club together. I think if you're looking at overall, we're talking about solidarity, whether it's solidarity with people with same spiritual beliefs, the same desires to get back to the land, or the same political beliefs.
What about how it's changed over the years? You think that happened a lot maybe in the 70s. Is that true or is that just a myth?
I think there was a wave in the 70s. People talk about the hippie communes. It becomes a cliche, and Diggers and Dreamers started out to try and prove that communes didn't come and go with the hippies. And the history goes back hundreds of years.
Diggers and Dreamers, that's interesting. This is like an index of these communes. That sounds like a bit of a challenge.
Yeah, we've been sort of cataloguing and looking at the different aspects for the last 25 years. We grew out of a thing called the Communes Network, which was the 1970s communities. It was sort of informal network of those, I suppose, what people would see as hippie communes. And Diggers and Dreamers became the sort of public face. We were there to promote the idea of community living. Our first book came out in 1990, and we've produced a journal all through to 2010, when we went completely online.
But we're now Generation Rent. I mean, for most people, they can only just hope to get a little box to live in, not, you know, to get together with others to get, you know, somewhere which is a bit bigger, a bit nicer. And I suppose really the big problem is bound to come is actually having to deal with loads of other people. Isn't it actually easier to keep a small family unit or an individual to live on your own?
It's not what it's cracked up to be, would be my answer to that. I lived in what I now tell people is a commune. We tried to call it anything else but when I lived there. But I lived in a commune for 20 years, just spent 10 years living in the outside world. And there are pros and cons on both sides. The amount of resources you can get by working collectively and owning property and with other people is beyond what I would ever be able to afford, beyond what most people would be able to afford. The downside, if you like, is you've got to work out ways of cooperating with people.
Okay, what about some successful communities or an unsuccessful? Because you know, it's fascinating when they work, and it's also fascinating when they don't work, and to figure out why.
We've got a mailing list of 400 communities in this country. The oldest surviving one in our directory started in 1898 is the White Way community. Very different from what it started out as, but it is still essentially a different sort of community. They collectively own the 41 acres in the Cotswolds, and they still have an anarchist form of land tenure. Failures, there have been lots. And there's a real question of how you judge success and failure. There have been a lot of failures of nuclear families. The divorce rate is sky high. I talked to a German studying German communities, communes and communities, and he was comparing them to things like small businesses. So most small businesses fail in the first 2 years. So do most communes. And he was saying if they get beyond the first 2 years, that's one sign of success. If it survives to bring up a generation of children, that's another measure of success. You've compared yourself favourably with a family unit. And then if you can actually get more than one generation.
Well, this is the thing, isn't it? If you can retain teenagers, you know, this is, I mean, I would imagine if I was a teenager brought up in a commune, my first thoughts would be to get out.
When we moved out of People in Common, our son went back because he couldn't stand living on his own with his mum and dad. He'd spent 17 years living communally and he couldn't stand living on his own. There are as many children who've grown up in communities who do go back as there are rebel and leave.
What about communities that people can visit? Are they mostly open or not?
Quite a lot are open to visitors. One easy way is woofing. What used to be working weekends on organic farms, I don't know what it stands for now. That's a very easy way for both the community and somebody to visit, have a look. At Diggers and Dreamers, we would recommend going and seeing a few different types, see what you think might suit. They're not really open in a sort of tourist come and have a look way. Some have sort of special open days, or will have a sort of one weekend a month when they accept visitors.
But most are open to visitors in one way or another. So where could people go to just find out what of these communities are around and which ones are open? So, you know, because this is the thing, is if you find one in your area, you may as well go and have a look.
Yeah, look at the Diggers and Dreamers website, www.diggersanddreamers.org.uk. We've got a list of all the communities there, and we've got sort of special sections for people who are particularly at any one time looking for volunteers or looking for new members. You can sort of check through them all. They're divided into types of community or by region across the country.
Okay, and remind us of the title of this book about the post-war communes again.
It's Communes Britannica. It starts in 1939, goes through the war. Got some very interesting, colourful characters. My favourite was the Process Church of the Final Judgment. A couple of ex-Scientologists who thought that Scientology didn't really take itself seriously enough. They then emigrated to America, which they found it much more fertile soil for setting up a Scientology offshoot than this country.
Okay, look, this is the $64,000 question, though, Chris. How do you know if it's a cult or a commune?
You look at the Nicholas Aubrey cultometer, there's a nice tick thing, a checklist, to tell you whether somewhere is a cult or not. And it's down to questions like, how is it to leave? What are you required to give in? And do you get it back when you come out? And things like that. I think there are very few cults, actually, particularly in this country. They're much more either a European or an American phenomena. And one person's cult's another person's chosen religion. That's a difficult one, I find. And you talk to a lot of people, even in the anti-cult movement, and they go, it is very difficult to tell the difference between the Jesus Army and an evangelical sect.
You know, in wider society, living's becoming much more difficult. Say, for example, for the unemployed, people haven't got any money, and cults, therefore, are likely to thrive. Ultimately, though, if you could point to one really good example across the country of a communal living experiment that's worked, where would you look at?
There's a very interesting place called Old Hall down in Suffolk. They are a almost classic 1970s big house commune, but they run a 35-acre organic farm, provide most of their food, and what they're struggling now with is how they get to that next generation. They have got children who want to move back in. And because of the way they were set up, the price of joining is beyond the means of their own children. And what they're doing...
This is a microcosm of the English village,
Absolutely.
Isn't it?
Absolutely. And what they're trying to do is use some of the asset in what is a huge house, some of the unused space, to set up a potentially affordable unit within their community. And I think that is a real test of maturity. Can you actually get to that stage where, not necessarily your own children, but another generation can come in and you haven't set up a structure that prices people out? Whether the ideology has changed from the original one or not, which I think probably it has, again, that's matured within somewhere like Old Hall.
So has the communes movement or communities, have they really learnt anything over the centuries? Actually, it is centuries, isn't it?
It is centuries. It's very difficult, I think. I think there are very few people who join a community who really... I mean, it's about, do you have to reinvent the wheel every time? I coined the phrase in the book, do you have to invent the common wheel? Do you have to reinvent the commonweal? And is there a purpose? And part of me says yes. Some of it is experiential. You've got to do it yourself. But there are one or two instances that I came across. People actually went and interviewed who clearly had come from one generation to the next. So I found one or two people from the sort of post-war pacifist sort of movement who were still around helping set up communes in the 70s. And there are people like me and other sort of 70s veterans, if we want to see ourselves like that, who are still engaging with the new sort of radical roots movements and the current back to the land sort of low impacts. And there have always been a small minority of people who've carried the torch from one generation to another.
So they're not going away anytime soon, these communities?
I don't think so. I think communal living has proved to be an incredibly robust form for a lot of people for centuries in this country and internationally.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. Okay.
Hello, this is Jeff Sparks with your What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday 12th of September, the Bon Jovi Experience will be performing with special guests at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Tickets are £12 in advance and doors open at 7:30pm. Also on 12th of September, Ainsley Lister, who has performed alongside blues legends such as Buddy Guy, John Mayall and Robert Cray, will be performing at the Tunnels in Bristol and Exeter Mews, Bristol. Tickets are £12 in advance and doors open at 7:30pm. On to Song of the Week, and I present Arizona Smoke Review. This group formed in 1980 and featured amongst its lineup Phil Beer and Steve Knightley, who later went on to form Show of Hands. This is from the album The Best of Bluegrass, and it's the song Black Mountain Rag.
Thank you.
was Arizona Smoke Review with Black Mountain Rag from the album The Best of Bluegrass. Into Saturday 13th of September, Roxy Magic, who are a tribute to Roxy Music, will be performing at the Tunnels in Bristol and Exeter Muse, Bristol. Tickets are £10 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. Finally, on Sunday 14th of September, Har Mar Superstar will be performing with support from Mother and also Reputant at the Exchange in Old Market, Bristol. Tickets are £12 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. That's all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialect is Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. It is on BCFM 93.2 at 11 a.m. on Mondays. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. That's dialectradio, one word. Or you can download this and many other podcasts from radioforall.net. That's radio, number four, all.net. Or you can listen online at bcfmradio.com/dialect. Dialect is a Bristol Broadband Cooperative production and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to contact us, you can through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733 or at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect. Thanks for listening. So until the same time next week, goodbye for now.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at midday, Oscar Pistorius has been cleared of murder. He's always insisted he shot his girlfriend in a tragic accident, believing her to be an intruder in his house last year. The athletes wept in court as the judge has been reading out her verdict. He could still be found guilty of manslaughter. Earlier, Judge Masipa says she thinks the sprinter did have control over his actions.
This court is satisfied that at the relevant time, the accused could distinguish between right and wrong, and that he could act in accordance with that distinction.
Scotland's First Minister is downplaying the significance of a decision by RBS to move its head office to England if Scots vote for independence next week. The bank says a yes would bring too many risks for it to stay based in Edinburgh, but Alex Salmond says he's seen a letter the boss of RBS sent to his staff this morning, proving the move is just a formality.
Let me read the key paragraph. It is my view as Chief Executive that any decision to move our registered headquarters would have no impact on everyday banking services used by our customers in Scotland and the rest of the British Isles. This is a technical procedure. It is not our intention to move operations or jobs.
A 13-year-old boy has appeared in court charged with murdering a woman found dead in the street in Smethwick in the West Midlands. Glynis Bensley, who is 47, suffered fatal head injuries. Amazon's announced plans to open a new East London office with the potential for more than 3,000 extra jobs. The building